The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
So, good morning. Is this volume okay if I speak like this? Okay, great. So today we start a two-part series. I'll be here next week also talking about the two modes of practice that are called serenity and insight. And these are highlighted as a pair in the teachings. And don't worry if you're not aware of that or don't, you know, haven't looked into that deeply. That's what we're going to look at in the next couple of talks. And, you know, how that really relates to our, you know, our practice as we do it here. So the practice that we do most often here at IMC is broadly called Vipassana practice. I think that's even on the front page of the website. So this word means insight or clear seeing. And the reason that it's highlighted is because this practice, or really a set of practices, insight practices, are what lead to liberation, to spiritual freedom, whatever that's going to look like for us. But the Buddha was very clear that certain conditions have to be in place for Vipassana practice to fulfill its deepest potential. It'll always do something, but to really, you know, to keep going, to keep developing it to its deepest, requires some other conditions to be in place. And one of them is a calm mind. So calming the mind is the domain of what we call serenity practice or tranquility practice. And so it's crucial to the path also to work on that. And my experience is that they go together in some way. I'll talk about that more. So you don't have to worry if it seems like you've got more of one than the other or whatever. They're going to come along together. In fact, there's this quote from the Buddha that says, "These two things pertain to true knowledge." What two? Serenity and insight. That's like breaking his teachings down into something very simple, only two things. Even the Four Noble Truths is four things, right? So this is pretty pretty broad and fundamental. So here's an image. Imagine that you're looking through a telescope and it's unstable, you know, like you're on a ship, say, or in an earthquake, or just holding it in your hands, and it's not very steady. You really can't focus very well on what you're trying to see, right? But if you put the telescope on a tripod or on solid ground, something that's much firmer, then suddenly the image is clear, right? It's a lot easier to see. So it's the clear seeing that we're looking for in practice. That's the Vipassana. We want to be able to see how things actually are, but it's necessary to stabilize the ability to look, and that is the domain of calming the mind. So that is what's called the kind of pair with Vipassana practice is called shamatha practice, or shamatha. You'll hear it pronounced that way. And so I'm going to be using that word, shamatha, and tranquility and serenity throughout this talk. You can understand that those basically mean the same thing. Now, it's also noted that serenity practices and insight practices help uproot different problems in the mind. So this is another reason that both are necessary, is that the mind has various distortions and challenges with the way it relates to reality. That's what causes our suffering. And these different modes of meditation help approach kind of, it's kind of like different aspects of those challenges. And so it's helpful to have kind of a two-pronged approach, if you will. It's said that attaining meditative calm is what reduces the mind's attachment to sensual pleasures, which we know is a challenge when we're caught up in that. We'll go more into what that means, particularly in this talk. And then seeing with insight, the Vipassana practice is said to dispel the ignorance that typically clouds the mind. And again, ignorance doesn't mean that you're stupid. It means that you're ignoring things, right? Certain things aren't being seen. And we'll talk about that too. So sometimes talking in this way, where we've divided this into two different types of practice, can give the impression that serenity practices are completely separate from insight practices and that you sort of have to choose one or the other. And some Buddhist texts and Dharma books even feed this notion. And there are ways in which these types of meditation are different, but they're also highly interrelated. I think they can even be seen as representing two different ways of approaching the same task, which is basically to train the mind and to learn about the mind. That's what we're doing here. So today, the focus is on these serenity practices. I'll be using the term tranquility also. Sometimes you'll also hear the word concentration practices. I think that's okay. It's accurate enough. But I won't use it too much in order to not to give the impression that we're doing some kind of a blocking out of reality and a laser-like focus on what we're looking at. So what is this idea of practicing in order to calm the mind? There are some ways that the meditation instructions are given that lead more in the direction of attaining a calm mind. In particular, probably most basically, you may have heard this instruction even, is just to return to whatever object you've chosen. So say you're meditating with the breath. A lot of us use the breath. And if you just happen to notice that your mind starts thinking sometime during meditation, like mine frequently does, then when you've noticed that, the instruction is to just come back to the breath, without judgment, all the usual instructions that we receive. That is actually a serenity instruction. Okay, it's an instruction to calm the mind. And the way it's working is that you're not investigating. You're not saying, now what is it that I got caught up in? Of course, you were busy thinking about something. And it's not that we go into what was that about, but we might note, that was a memory or that was anxiety about the future. We sort of notice what it was that the mind was doing and what that feels like maybe. Oh, anxiety feels like this. That's more a Vipassana instruction. So the serenity instruction is just drop it and come back. And by not feeding that other way of thinking, that the energy doesn't go into that as much. And so the mind has more energy left for being present with the object. That causes the calmness. It's a great way to start practicing. And in fact, you can just keep doing that for a really long time. It's fine. So don't investigate, essentially. Just come back. Now, I'm talking about an object in this case, like the breath or the body, but I should emphasize that in serenity practice, we don't have to have a single object. It's possible. Often, these practices are done with some kind of object. It's actually easier to have an object, I find, something that the mind can rest with, can settle on, can feel at home with, can return to as an anchor. All of these are words that pertain to having an object of our meditation. It's also possible, though, to become perfectly concentrated, serene, calm, using not having one object. So you'll call this is called sometimes open awareness practice. Sometimes the practice of mindfulness of mind that Andrea teaches can be done in the mode of attaining calm, where basically we are with the changing experience that's happening. First we feel a thought and then a bodily sensation and then an emotion and then a memory and then another bodily sensation. And we don't ever get distracted from that. We have the aim is to have continuous mindfulness of that, but not to try to force the mind to be with one particular thing. This also leads to concentration. I don't want to give the impression that concentration is just this one single focus on an object. There is perfectly good concentration on changing objects is what it's called. But overall, the aim is the same in both of these. It's to have continuous mindfulness with what's happening in the present moment, not with what the mind is thinking about, conjuring, fantasizing on its own. That's sort of the mark of mindfulness practice. I should mention, by the way, since I just said mindfulness practice, that mindfulness is absolutely critical for concentration and for insight practice. Sometimes people think, oh, there's mindfulness practice and then there's concentration practice. Those are not different, actually. I can't really imagine a concentrated mind that isn't mindful. That doesn't make sense to me. I think they really, it comes right out of, concentration comes right out of highly continuous mindfulness. Okay, so earlier I said the maybe intriguing idea that concentration practices or serenity practices help uproot attachment to sensual pleasure. What is that about? So it happens that a calm, gathered mind, I mean, just think about the times that you've experienced some kind of meditative calm, because we all have. We've at some point had a meditation where we sat and things were relatively stable and we thought, ah, yeah. Think about, you know, even if it was only 5 minutes, or even if it was some time when you were walking in nature or driving, some time when the mind was calm, there's a certain pleasure to that, isn't there? And that doesn't mean that you had nothing to think about. It doesn't mean that you didn't have things going on in your life, but at that moment you weren't wrapped up in them, right? And you were able to kind of just be there with what was unfolding. And there's a type of pleasure to that. This type of pleasure, the Buddha says, is not to be feared. Isn't that interesting? It's not that we normally go around fearing pleasure, most of us, and I don't think that's the intention. But I think we can have an awareness that pursuing certain types of pleasure, at least with the energy that we sometimes pursue them, has a tendency to cause problems. Have you noticed this? Like, let's say you're really fixated on getting a certain thing, getting a certain item of clothing that you really want, and you go to 10 different stores and you look online for hours for this particular thing. It may be that the process of that causes anxiety in your mind, it causes agitation. It may be that you're hogging the computer and your partner can't use it. It may be that you're spending a lot of time that you could have been doing other things like meditating or, you know, serving or something else. So there are kind of trade-offs around pursuing this item of clothing that could be causing harm or distraction or disturbance in the rest of your life. So this is what the Buddha's pointing toward when he says this type of pleasure, the pleasure of a concentrated mind or a calm mind, is not to be feared. It doesn't cause problems for yourself or for other people to have a mind like that. So engaging in it and indeed steeping the mind in this kind of meditative calm when it's available, it's not always, but when it is, steeping it into that leads to a reduction of sensual desire or an interest in pursuing these other kinds of sense pleasures. This sutta describes a little bit about that. This is from a quote attributed to the Buddha from the Majjhima Nikaya. There are 5 strands of sense desire. What are these 5? Forms cognizable by the eye that are wished for, desirable, agreeable and endearing, bound up with sensual desire and tempting to lust. Sounds cognizable by the ear, odors cognizable by the nose, flavors cognizable by the tongue, tangibles cognizable by the body, and so forth. These are the 5 strands of sense pleasure. The pleasure and joy arising dependent on these 5 strands of sense desire, that is called sensual pleasure. Okay, so it's pretty clear. I mean, this language might be a little bit unusual. Remember, this was an oral tradition. So basically, it's seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, and touching in ways that are pleasant. And the Buddha is acknowledging this is pleasant. There are pleasant things about this world. He doesn't say that this is wrong. However, he next says, now, if someone were to say, this is the highest pleasure and joy that can be experienced, I would not concede that. And why not? Because there is another kind of pleasure which surpasses that pleasure and is more sublime. And what is this pleasure? Here, quite secluded from sensual desires, secluded from unwholesome states of mind, a practitioner enters upon and abides in the first meditative absorption, that's a type of calm, which is accompanied by applied and sustained thought, and has in it joy and pleasure born of seclusion. This is the other kind of pleasure which surpasses that sensual pleasure and is more sublime. So I think this is an interesting thing. He goes on, but I'm going to stop here for a moment. So, first of all, this thing called the first meditative absorption, that's a type of jhana, and we don't need to go into that in great detail, although I may say a little bit more about it later. And it's not that we all get there all the time. I think this can apply to any kind of meditative calm that we begin to experience in sitting. And notice that it says it's accompanied by applied and sustained thought. Thought is not gone in this kind of practice. And has in it joy and pleasure born of seclusion. And that seclusion means both the physical seclusion of sitting by yourself quietly and the mental seclusion of not engaging in a lot of the what are called the hindrances of the mind. So a lot of lust and aversion, liking and disliking, these kinds of things that the mind gets caught up in, doubt, other things. So once the mind kind of lets go of that and is sitting calmly, there's this pleasure that's there. And it's fine that there's still some degree of thought. Usually that doesn't mean discursive thinking, but it can mean thought about the practice. It can mean thought about the object. You think about the breath while you're focusing on it. It's fine. So I think this is interesting. This is not, you know, this is not pointing towards something that's totally unachievable. And it is highlighting that this kind of pleasure is good. This is good. Sit down and you happen to have any degree of this, celebrate that, enjoy it. It's okay. It's okay. But it's interesting, the next line of this sutta. If someone were to say, this is the highest pleasure that can be experienced, I would not concede that. And why not? Because there is another kind of pleasure which surpasses that pleasure and is more sublime. And what is that pleasure? Here, with the stilling of applied and sustained thought, a monk enters upon, or a practitioner enters upon and abides in the second meditative absorption. And it goes on, because there are higher degrees of calm that include, you know, basically less and less activity of the mind. So you eliminate the thinking and then eventually turn away even from the sort of rapturous pleasure that can come. So this is interesting though, right? So basically what's happening here, let's step back now and say what's the process happening in the mind here as it learns to sit in meditation in this way. Basically the mind is finding something better than sense pleasure, basically. And so, you know, the chocolate cake is good. There's nothing wrong with chocolate cake when we're not in meditation. But really, how much can we enjoy that piece of chocolate cake? It's gone in 5 minutes. And if we tried to eat an infinite number of them, it really wouldn't be that pleasurable. After about, what, the third, maybe even before the third, wouldn't be that pleasurable. But we can sit in meditation if we're in a fairly calm state for quite a long time. It's a different kind of pleasure. It's a different realm. So not surprisingly, as the mind learns that there's something better, it's willing to let go of its attachment to this other thing. Doesn't mean we let go of chocolate cake. Great, chocolate cake appears. It's a birthday party, we'll eat it, we'll enjoy it. It's fun to be with people and do that. But the mind isn't so attached to it. There isn't this sense of, if I don't have this cake in my life, I'm not going to be fulfilled. I'm not going to be happy. And, you know, I'm making it humorous because I don't think anyone in this room really thinks that chocolate cake is going to make them happy. But we have other things like that. And this is pointing toward a path by which the mind, we use the mind's interest in pleasure to help it to let go of kinds of pleasure that aren't that good for it in the long run, that aren't ultimately reliable kinds of pleasure. Yeah? So this is a pathway to use the tendency that's already there in your mind to want things that are pleasant, not want things that are unpleasant. Great. Use that to find this other kind of pleasure that's actually even better. So, this is the process by which the mind lets go of attachment to sense pleasures through meditative calm. Here's another sutta quote. When serenity is developed, what benefit does one experience? The mind is developed. When the mind is developed, what benefit does one experience? This translation says, lust is abandoned. We could also say attachment to sensual desire is abandoned. Inappropriate sense desire is abandoned. Sometimes around this point, people start saying, well, that's not my mind. You know, this is all very nice what she's talking about, but it's hard for me to relate to that. And I want to offer some encouragement in that actually the fact that you came here and sat still for 45 minutes is like way more than a lot of people do. You know, how many people can't sit with themselves calmly for 45 minutes? So in many ways, even if the mind was busy and there was thinking and so forth, there's a lot happening just in being able to be with your experience, to be in this room, to come to this place. You actually have a lot more calm than you think you do, maybe compared to the average out there in the world. And any degree that you attain here is a benefit to both yourself and the world out there. This is good stuff the Buddha's talking about. I want to offer also some images from the suttas that help us understand a little bit about what this kind of meditative calm kind of feels like in the body. It's a pointer. If you haven't experienced it, then consider it something that your heart will hear at some level. And if you have, then consider maybe what meaning it has to you. So, just as if a skilled bathman or bathman's apprentice would pour bath powder into a brass basin and knead it together, sprinkling it again and again with water, so that her ball of bath powder, saturated, moisture-laden, permeated within and without, would nevertheless not drip. Even so, the meditator permeates this very body with the rapture and pleasure born of seclusion. There is nothing of her entire body unpervaded by rapture and pleasure born of seclusion. So this is the sense, now we don't use bath powder these days, but this is the sense that, you know, this this calm pervades the body. It's in the body. Of course, you know, the mind is what's getting calm, but I like that it's so integrated. You know, the idea is not that we're leaving behind our body. We're taking this very body with its aches and pains and whatever it's got, and we're saturating it with a sense of ease. And I have found that there can be calm even if there's some discomfort in the body. They're not incompatible. And so this sense of connecting with our body is very important. Here's the next image for a different, slightly deeper kind. Just like a lake with spring water welling up from within, having no inflow from the east, west, north, or south, and with the skies supplying abundant showers time and again, so that the cool fount of water welling up from within the lake would permeate and pervade, suffuse and fill it with cool waters, there being no part of the lake unpervaded by the cool waters. Even so, the meditator permeates this very body with the rapture and pleasure born of concentration. There is nothing of her entire body unpervaded by rapture and pleasure born of concentration. So this is the sense, this is there's a lake, imagine, with an internal spring feeding it. And so this is the idea that this pleasure is somehow dependent only on itself. It's feeding itself. We're no longer needing things from the outside to sustain this kind of feeling. Just as in a lotus pond, some of the lotuses, born and growing in the water, stay immersed in the water and flourish without standing up out of the water, so that they are permeated and pervaded, suffused and filled with cool water from their roots to their tips, and nothing of those lotuses would be unpervaded by cool water. Even so, the meditator permeates this very body with the pleasure divested of rapture. There is nothing of her entire body unpervaded with pleasure divested of rapture. So notice we're no longer saying rapture and pleasure, now we're saying pleasure divested of rapture. So there are other details in here, but essentially the mind is letting go of even that kind of excitement and this feeling of the fountain filling the lake. That's kind of an exciting, dynamic image, right? And so now it says that settles out, and you just have this lotus sitting in very cool, still water. And finally, just as if a person were sitting covered from head to foot with a white cloth, so that there were no part of her body to which the white cloth did not extend, even so the meditator sits, permeating the body with a pure, bright awareness. There is nothing of her entire body unpervaded by pure, bright awareness. As she remains thus heedful, ardent, and resolute, any memories and resolves related to the household life are abandoned, and with their abandoning, her mind gathers and settles inwardly, grows unified and centered. Okay, so that's the fourth level of concentration. And in this case, we have just the white cloth permeated with a pure, bright awareness. So that's not to say that we achieve this sitting down. But I'd like to point out that in this, there is, first of all, no mention of a specific object, is there? It just talks about the way the body feels, basically, the way the body and the mind feel. So if you can get there using the breath, the body, a kasina, a reflection, you can also use this changing concentration on changing objects. I like that it's not specific. The Buddha was careful, I think, not to limit the way we practice. So these are feelings that arise, ways of being, mind states that arise through calming the mind, through withdrawing our attention from these things that distract us. This is the possibility. Now, a question that people often ask at this point is, don't you get attached to that? Well, sure, you know, the mind can get attached to anything, but that is a terrible reason not to calm the mind, okay? There is often fear of this kind of these kind of images. They're strong images, and I read them deliberately in order to give the mind something to be aware of, you know, the potential. And yet, now I'm going to go back to what the Buddha said. This type of pleasure is not to be feared. It's very interesting to me that people become afraid. Oh, aren't I going to withdraw from the world completely? Aren't I going to forget about my family? I mean, it does say memories related to the household life are abandoned. They're abandoned under these conditions. When you're in your life, outside of meditation, you get off the cushion because what? You have to eat, you have to sleep, you have to go to the bathroom. The body doesn't go away. When you're not under these conditions, you care about those other things. It's actually a condition to be able to reach concentration like this that you lead an ethical life. And so you don't have to worry that you're going to not do your duties anymore, you're not going to care about people anymore. I have not found that to be the case at all. So don't worry about getting attached to that pleasure. It's a very good thing to develop the mind that way. In fact, you become more caring, more effective, etc. And the reason that this, you know, let me point out then that because you only have this kind of mind under these kind of conditions, that's why this is not liberation, okay? This is not that liberation feels like you're covered from head to toe in a white cloth all the time. This is a conditional experience. Liberation is something different. That's why these practices are not, in the end, ultimately liberating. But developing the mind this way is really, really important to create the conditions for the mind to be able to see clearly. As you can imagine, when the mind is sitting there, not at all concerned with what's happening in life, busy with all those problems, you get a chance to really see how the mind is operating. If this concentrated mind is turned toward issues like, how does suffering arise? That's really powerful. You can see that very clearly. Okay, so I've started to introduce, actually, the role of serenity in the path of awakening. So this is not the end. You know, this is not the aim, I should say. This is not the aim of practice, is to develop this. At the Buddha's time, there were people who thought this was the aim of practice. In fact, some of his early teachers were said to be people who developed very high states of concentration, actually higher than this one, and believed that that was the end, that was the purpose. And the Buddha learned that, but said, I only have that while I'm sitting in meditation. So there's got to be something else. I'm trying to end suffering in my heart. And so he taught, he went on and found, you know, for himself that there are, there's more work to be done. And so I want to talk a little bit about the role of serenity practices on the path of awakening. And we'll, you know, we'll talk more about insight practices next week. But the Buddha's own path to awakening, in fact, included the discovery that the pleasant states of shamatha or samadhi are part of the path. You know, he didn't say, oh, this doesn't work, I'm going to throw the whole thing out. He said, actually, how can I use this? In fact, there's a time when he remembered. You know, he was kind of stuck in his practice. He had all this concentration and all this ascetic practice, and it wasn't freeing his mind. And then he remembered when he was a child becoming concentrated, just sitting under a tree as a boy. So this is, again, an indication that this is not something totally unachievable. 6-year-old boy sitting under a tree. He reached a state of calm where he was just completely at peace with his experience while he was watching a ceremony, plowing ceremony out in the field. And he thought to himself, could this be the path toward liberation? Yes, I think it is. I think using this kind of pleasure, using this kind of calm, is going to be helpful in seeing the truth and freeing the mind. So it's useful here to introduce another framework for what qualities of mind are supposed to be potentially present in order for the mind to awaken. So many teachings of the Buddha emphasize certain factors of the mind that are called the factors of awakening, not surprisingly. And these are, I'll read them, there are 7 of them, you don't have to memorize them. Mindfulness, investigation, energy, joy, tranquility, concentration, and equanimity. And so that's like kind of a framework. It's like you want these 7 factors to be present in the mind in order to awaken. And on the other hand, I've been talking about what? Serenity and insight. Okay, so how do these relate? Are they related? I think they are, and I think it's useful to consider how they're related. So there is a link between them, and it's illuminating for our practice, I think, to explore it just briefly. So it's helpful to know that the 7 factors of awakening are usually divided into 2 groups of 3, plus mindfulness. And so mindfulness is first, and it stands by itself. And then the next 3, which are investigation, energy, and joy, these are called the energizing factors, and they kind of enliven the mind. And then the second set of 3, which is tranquility, concentration, and equanimity, are called the calming factors, and they're about a mind that is more tranquil. So imagine if your mind had all 7 of these strong at the same time. Wouldn't that be an interesting state of mind? Because it would be highly energized, joyful, investigative, you know, really interested in what's going on, and it would be tranquil, concentrated, and equanimous about what was arising. So this is actually a really interesting mixture of calming and energizing factors. So basically the mind is in a very special state. It's vibrantly energized, but also steady, calm, and balanced. So you can imagine that a mind like that is actually very powerful. And that is what we're aiming for in order that the mind is poised to be able to free itself. So when the mind is developing toward that state, you know, we don't necessarily have all those factors present at every moment, but your mind actually has the potential for all of those. Every one of us can have and have experienced degrees of all of those. So when we're developing the mind toward having those qualities, mindfulness is needed in order to bring about a balance of them and not develop too much of this or too little of that or something. Kind of like balancing the flavors of a meal, is that you want to have the salty and the sweet and the bitter and the sour and the umami all in balance at the same time. If you're going to develop energizing factors and calming factors, they've got to be in balance somehow in order that the mind doesn't get off. So, for example, if the mind begins in a state of sluggishness, for example, if you were falling asleep during the meditation today, that would not be the time to develop the calming factors of awakening, right? Not the time to develop tranquility, concentration, and equanimity. Instead, focus on developing investigation, energy, and joy. There are analogies given, I won't read them, but in the suttas where basically the Buddha says, look, if you have a small fire and you want it to blaze up, would it be helpful to throw wet grass and wet sticks on it? No, of course not. That's the equivalent of taking a mind that's a little bit sluggish and trying to develop tranquility, concentration, and equanimity. Doesn't work. On the other hand, if you put dry grass and dry sticks on a small fire, it will blaze up. And that's like developing the energizing factors of awakening. And then the reverse, when the mind is agitated, right? Suppose you have a big fire and you want it not to be blazing so high. Should you throw dry grass and sticks on it? No, because that would be like developing the energizing factors at a time when the mind is agitated. It's not a good idea. So that's a time to develop the calming factors. So there's some wisdom in choosing which qualities of mind we're bringing forth through our practice. So you can imagine then a link. I hope I've set this up in not going too quickly, but you can imagine a link between serenity practice and the calming factors of the mind, right? Tranquility, concentration, and equanimity. Those are the practices that bring about this factor called serenity that the Buddha pointed toward as essential. And those are also half of the awakening factors. This is another way of pointing out that serenity and insight are both needed. They're both needed on the path. Now, the other half of the equation, which could be leaned toward, is that the insight practices might be related to the energizing factors of mind, right? And that's broadly true. You wouldn't be wrong to say serenity is more about the calming factors and insight is more about the energizing factors. And I think it's a nice link. So if you want to make that link in your mind, that's a good way to think about it. It's a little more complicated than that, and so not complicated, but there are nuances to that, which we'll talk about more next week in order that we can understand better how serenity and insight bring the mind toward its ability to awaken in the same way that the factors of awakening do. But I think it has practical value, so I hope what this is pointed toward with this framework of the factors of awakening is that it helps us to realize what to cultivate when. So if you sit down and your mind is feeling sluggish, you know, the main hindrance in your mind is sloth and torpor, why not work on these other, you know, these more energizing factors? Or if the mind is in a very agitated state, that's a great time to say, you know what, I'm going to remember those images that Kim read about the bath powder and the lotuses and the white cloth. This is the time to try to calm the mind. So starting to develop a little bit of wisdom about how our practice can unfold can really be helpful. And it doesn't mean you have to think about it a lot. It means you have to just listen to your heart and realize, oh yeah, what we're aiming for is a mind that's both energized and calm. That's what we're aiming for, serenity, wisdom, insight. These things all have to come together. And we'll talk more about all these different terms next week. But basically the aim through serenity practices is to create calm waters so your ship is floating peacefully and you can see with your telescope, or alternatively you get your tripod in place so that when you put your camera on it you're taking a nice clear picture, that kind of thing. Basically we want to make sure that we can see clearly, and that's the purpose of calming the mind. I think I'm going to stop there with ideas and ask if there's something coming up from your practice, or if you have questions about how to understand this, or if you have comments from what you've experienced. It'd be helpful to share some of your wisdom in the room also. Oh, and let's use a microphone. Anyone? Yeah, Carla. Thank you.
Can you hear me?
Yeah.
Just the phrase, well, lately I've been working with children, combining mindfulness with creative writing, and I'm struck by how, I mean, especially a couple of these kids, incredible insights come with just looking at a leaf.
Mm.
So I guess my question or my discovery is their discovery of sensory awareness, being allowed to have time for sensory awareness.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not an overstimulation. It's something that combines insight right there.
Mm-hmm.
it's as if they're not writing the words. They would, I don't know if they would say that, but some of them are so sophisticated and deep. I've shared them with Gil. It blew me away.
Children are amazing, aren't
right.
they?
So again, from the mouth of babes and making me more aware about this is our birthright here. Somehow we have forgotten about sensory awareness, which, you know, when you see a toddler running to an ocean, you know, the first wave coming, it's amazing.
Yeah.
I don't know what my question is, but I guess there's a balance between, I think, sensory stimulation too much, but sensory awareness is good stuff.
Yeah, I would, maybe if I could frame it in terms of what we were talking about today, there's a certain degree of calmness that comes through what you're calling sensory awareness. There has to be a willingness to sit there and, for example, look at the leaf for 10, 20 seconds and really see it carefully instead of our usual very casual way of just breezing over it or not even seeing it. That's an agitated mind that's not paying very close attention to its here and now experience, but settling into that, taking the time to connect with what's actually happening, I think a lot of that can go in this realm of serenity that we talked about. That's why, I think that's why so many of the images, like the ones that we read, are about the body, right? They're about being able to connect with our physical sensation in just a direct, simple way right here. That's how we're going to be able to see something. Because you're right, all of the Dharma is actually available in a leaf if we took the time to really look at it. Thank you.
So my agitated mind has to laugh at itself. When you talked about the Buddha saying that there's nothing to fear, I first went to Descartes, I think, therefore I am. And that one of my fears would be that that if I stopped thinking, I wouldn't be here. There would be nobody.
Yeah, it's interesting, isn't it? And do you have a question?
No, that was just sort of a confession.
Well, I was. I mean, I'm probing a little bit to see. I suspect you're saying that for a reason. What does it feel like when you, you know, when you have this thought, if I stop thinking, I won't exist?
Well, I think I said that because I recognized that when you said the fear, that was the first thing I thought you were going to say.
Uh-huh.
And then I realized that was my thought, and that, you know, I know what that's not true, so I guess I'm happy to know that, you know, that that's not the case. But I recognize that that I have had that concern before, and I, you know, and I think a lot of people confuse some of what this is all about with passivity.
Yeah, this is not a passive practice at all, in my experience at least. There are parts that we're definitely not in control of. We shouldn't have the delusion that we're going to create our own liberation and I'm going to be the one who's liberated. That the ego really wants to be the one who's liberated. Doesn't quite work like that either. But I think it's normal in developing concentration practice to go through some fear like that. I think that shows a little bit that it's worth its salt because we're beginning to challenge our usual way of experiencing the world. And the feelings that come in concentration, I mean, these images of the lotus and the bath powder and the white cloth and so forth, these are in some ways very enticing images. And we think, oh, yeah, when I'm agitated, I sure wish I could feel like that. But if that were the main experience and we didn't have that sense of I am Kim operating in the world in this way, it's true, these images don't include that, do they? And so the mind has to make a choice that that's the direction it wants to go. And I have great faith that it does eventually. But it's very good to be aware of that fear that this is a different way of being, and is that going to be okay? And that's one function of Sangha and of a teacher, is to help create conditions where that is okay, to explore these different ways of being and to learn by dipping our toe in first that it's okay. It's okay, yeah. Does that help? Okay. Yeah, Marie.
I also had a fear, and that was of being blissed out.
A fear of being blissed out. What does that mean?
That I would lose myself in it.
Uh-huh. Lose yourself.
Sort of being out of control.
Ah, being out of control, yes. That can also come up in serenity practice, a sense of something more, something surprising or more powerful than we expected coming up within us, yeah? And feeling like we might be overwhelmed by it. Mm-hmm. That's another reason why the Buddha says this is not to be feared, is that these images are meant to help us understand that that those feelings are okay. It's very similar, actually, to what Ellen was saying.
Yeah.
It's just framed in slightly different words. And I think it's fine to let the practice unfold as it does. So I have a sense that the mind isn't going to plunge in farther than it can at a given time. Now, that's not entirely true. Some people push themselves in certain ways. But if you allow the practice to unfold naturally, then the mind learns bit by bit that it's okay to go, you know, a little bit into a realm that feels different and then come back, right? It's a little bit like, you know, when a child goes out the door and the street is scary, but to an adult, the street isn't scary, right? Because you know what it is, you know how to navigate it and so forth. Or a child goes to school for the first time, really scary, but the parent knows, you know, it's going to be okay. This is not, you know, this is, but, you know, you take the fear seriously, but you still allow, you know, allow that experience to happen, to unfold, to the mind to get used to it, the child to get used to it. This is not to imply that we're all children, but there are ways in which our minds are not used to experiencing certain things. And so it has this response of, I don't know what this is, I don't get it. It feels unfamiliar and scary to me. And in the same way that we slowly educate a child about how to be in the world or how to see things in a leaf, we can educate the mind that way also through these, the slow development of these practices, the gradual development. Does that make sense? Yeah. Okay, good. Well, it's after time. Did you have a comment also? No, okay. All right, so we'll stop here, and I'm available if anybody has any other questions. But we'll come back next week and talk about insight practice, which we've all also done and has its own set of ways that it interacts with the mind and things that it does and discoveries to be made. So thanks.